Live from the Milwaukee PBS studios in downtown Milwaukee, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association Foundation presents the 2022 U.S. Senate debate with incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson and Democratic challenger Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Now, here's Wisconsin Broadcasters Association President and CEO Michelle Vetterkind.
Good evening. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and its member radio and television stations are pleased to welcome you to this U.S. Senate debate. Tonight's event originates from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the studios of Milwaukee PBS. We have a team of broadcasters from communities large and small across the state involved in bringing this debate to you. Tonight's debate continues the WBA's longstanding commitment to excellence and public service. The debate is underwritten by the WBA Foundation and supported by a grant from the Wisconsin Association of Independent Colleges and Universities and the Wisconsin Counties Association. Now let's go to our moderator, a veteran Wisconsin broadcaster, member of the WBA Hall of Fame, and professor of leadership and media integrity at Loyola University Chicago, Jill Geisler.
Good evening. On Tuesday, November 8th, Wisconsin voters will decide who will be their U.S. Senator for the next 6 years. Our goal tonight is to help you make an informed choice as you hear from the two major party candidates, incumbent Senator Ron Johnson and Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. The candidates have agreed to the rules. For each question, they will be told the length of time they have for responses, either 1 minute or 30 seconds. They and I can see countdown clocks. When they hit their time limit, I will advise them. If they continue, I'll note it, and their microphone will cease to work. If candidates fail to answer a specific question or change the subject, I'll exercise the moderator's option to call that out and give them just 30 seconds to give a specific answer. Please note, this debate will provide an additional service for voters. Many complex issues require deeper context and verification, especially when charges and countercharges are exchanged or when statistics and shorthand terms are used. So, thanks to our debate's data team, we will be providing you links to additional research materials about our key topics. To read more about a subject, follow the link you'll see on screen or follow the WBA on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. Our hashtag is WBADebate. Now, the order of response for the first and last question was determined by coin toss. And with that, let's begin with the first question from a member of our question team, Kim Murphy from WITI in Milwaukee. Now, you're seeing her picture. Despite her hard work, she can't be here because of COVID protocols. So she's asked her teammates to present her questions for her. So with that, let's go to Dale Ryman of WSAW in Waukesha for Kim.
Thank you, Jill. Good afternoon. Good evening, gentlemen. We want to start with the topic of marijuana legislation. This news just coming out yesterday that President Biden is pardoning thousands of Americans convicted of simple possession of marijuana under federal law. He says it's a dramatic step toward decriminalizing the drug and addressing charging practices that disproportionately impact people of color. What is your position on the federal legalization of marijuana? Senator Johnson, we'll start with you, and you have 1 minute.
Well, good evening. First, I want to thank the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and the Wisconsin Public TV station for hosting this. I also want to thank the panelists for participating. I hope the questions will be fair and balanced and really focused on the issues that really impact Wisconsinites, so we can have a good discussion on 40-year high inflation, record gas prices, skyrocketing crime, an open border, and the flood of illegal drugs. Talking about drugs, marijuana. I think it ought to be a state-by-state decision. I think the only thing on a federal basis, it doesn't make any sense for where marijuana is legal, that we're not able to use a banking system, so these marijuana companies have mountains of cash, which just leads to a potential for crime. So I can see federal legislation to open up the banking system to those states where you have legalized marijuana, but I would suggest any state should really take a look seriously at the harm being done by the legalization of marijuana and
Senator,
consider that very carefully.
Thank you, Senator.
Lieutenant Governor?
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you for hosting the debate. Thank you for the question. Now, I've long supported the full legalization of marijuana as a member of the legislature. And now, as Lieutenant Governor, and it's what I hope that we could accomplish as a nation if I'm elected to the United States Senate. Far too many people fall victim to a system that incarcerates folks for marijuana possession. Now, this is something that's legal in our neighboring states, in Illinois, in Michigan, even medical marijuana in Minnesota. Those states are receiving huge benefits because of the revenue that's generated from the legalization of marijuana. That's money that goes to their schools, money that goes to their roads. Most importantly, it's money that Wisconsin misses out on. If we have federal legalization of marijuana, we could do so much more in this state. Now, it's unfortunate that we have people who are decades behind on this issue. It's people who are supported by the pharmaceutical industry, where we have an issue with overprescription of drugs. Now, marijuana is harmless, and marijuana is something that states all over the country have embraced, and they are seeing benefits as a result of it.
Thank you. Let's go now to Mark Leland.
This is a question on conditions for bail. The trial of Daryl Brooks got underway this week in Waukesha County. He's charged with killing six people in the Waukesha Christmas parade after getting out of jail on bail. The case has raised the issue of which pretrial defendant should be kept behind bars. A bill introduced in Congress last year discourages states from making the payment of money a condition for pretrial defendants to be released from jail. It details how defendants with access to money can buy their way out of jail while poorer defendants remain locked up. Would you agree that conditions for keeping a defendant locked up should be based on whether the defendant is a threat to public safety and or likely to fail to appear back in court and not the ability to pay bail? Lieutenant Governor, we'll begin with you. You have 1 minute.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate this question because it has been sensationalized and it's also been mischaracterized. Now, I supported bail reform. Now, under my plan, dangerous people don't get to buy their way out of prison. Now, Senator Johnson may not have encountered a problem he couldn't buy his way out of, but that's not reality for the majority of people in this state. And what has come to light is how people have unfortunately used the Waukesha tragedy, even going so far as to use it in commercials, re-traumatizing families. Now, under my plan, the perpetrator wouldn't have been able to get out if he paid $1,000 or $100,000. This is about keeping people safe by making sure that those who are likely to offend and cause harm do not get to buy their way out of jail. That's the system that we have now. And this sort of reform that I support has been supported by Republicans all across the country as well.
All right. Senator, you have 1 minute.
We have a huge problem with skyrocketing crime. One of the issues is we're not keeping criminals in jail. And Lieutenant Governor, when he was in the legislature, wrote the bill to eliminate cash bail. That is one of the methods, that we can use to make sure the dangerous criminals stay in jail. Lieutenant Governor and Governor, their goal as they entered their office was to reduce the prison population by 50%. They've already reduced it by about 15%, and they've paroled about 884 criminals. You'd think they'd start with nonviolent. No, only 11% were nonviolent, about 100 criminals. The other were violent criminals, including 44 child rapists, 270 criminals who primarily committed or at least attempted murder, and the murders were horrific. So if you want to reduce crime, first of all, you have to fully fund the police, and of course, my opponent is opposed to fully funding police budgets, but we need to keep criminals in jail.
Senator, thank you.
Well, I'd like to...
Time is up, and we're going to give you time at the end. If there is something that you feel has been misrepresented, you'll have time at the end in a final question.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay? Thank you. All right, let's go to Monse Ricosa of Telemundo, Wisconsin.
Thank you. There's agreement on both sides of the aisle that something about our country's immigration system needs to change, but how is the sticking point, especially as it can affect employment rate in Wisconsin? By the year 2030, it's estimated that the working population in our state will shrink by 130,000 people if we don't have an increase in migration. Would you look at making a path to citizenship more accessible as a solution to our impending employment crisis? You'll have 1 minute. Senator Johnson, we'll start with you.
Well, in order to have immigration reform, we have to first secure the border. And we, by and large, had it secured under the previous administration. We'd stopped the flow of unaccompanied children and family units exploiting our asylum laws. We'd actually even cut in half adult immigration until President Biden took office, and then the border was opened up. We are dealing with about 7,000 people per day being encountered, processed, and dispersed throughout America. It's about 3 million people. It's also opened up our border to the flow of deadly drugs. Illegal immigration is not good or humane for the immigrants. They are being abused by the human traffickers, about an $18 billion a year business. How do you think, for example, young women pay off their human trafficking fee? The human trafficking, the sex trafficking, that is an untold story, and unfortunately the news media is covering up for the Biden administration.
Senator, I do have to exercise the moderator's option. The question was about immigration reform.
So you have to first secure the border.
And understand.
Once you've done that, then we have to fix the asylum standard. Right now we have a very low standard of credible fear. All somebody has to do is step into the country, say they're afraid to go home, even though they don't even come close to qualifying for asylum. We let them in, we're so backlogged, that's why we have about 3 million people into this country since the Biden administration took office. That's completely out of control.
All right, Lieutenant Governor.
Well, thank you so much. Now, our immigration system is completely broken, and I fully support comprehensive immigration reform that creates a path to citizenship for our dreamers and for their families. What we're doing right now does not work. And I'll tell you, people all across the state of Wisconsin agree. It is unfortunate that we have a member of the United States Senate does not side with the majority of people in Wisconsin. Now, I've spent a lot of time talking to family farmers. They know that fixing our broken immigration system and creating that pathway to citizenship isn't just a humane thing to do, it's also good for our economy, as you mentioned. This is something we have to do. We can create a system that keeps our border safe, that treats people with dignity and respect, does not subject our children to the horrors of family separation. Now, the senator had 12 years to do something about this. He even had a chance with a bipartisan infrastructure law because there was funding in there for border modernization, but the senator decided to play politics instead of doing the right thing.
Thank you very much. Let's go to A.J. Bayatpour from WKOW in Madison.
Gentlemen, this is a two-part question on the issue of Social Security. The Social Security Trust Fund is currently on pace to be underfunded by 2034. Senator Johnson, to address this concern, you have said you support making the program a discretionary one, meaning Congress could make changes to it in each budget cycle. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, you have said you oppose that. First, why should or should not Social Security be made discretionary? And beyond that, what specifically should Congress do to ensure the program remains fully funded? Lieutenant Governor Barnes, you'll go first. You each have 1 minute.
Thank you so much. When I think about Social Security, I think about my grandparents, I think about my parents, I think about so many other retired Americans who paid into a system who deserve to retire with some dignity and respect. Now, it's unfortunate that Senator Johnson said that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. There was an even instance where he called Social Security candy. He called Social Security candy. This was keeping people who have worked their entire lives afloat. And the threat to take that away from them does not sit well with me, along with most other people. Now, what we need to do is not just make Social Security solvent. We should strengthen Social Security. We can do that by making sure the wealthy pay their fair share. We need to make sure that billionaires are paying more into this system. Now, the senator goes on about the deficit, but he had no problem blowing a $2 trillion hole into the deficit by passing the 2017 tax bill that gave $215 million in tax deductions to his biggest donors in a single year. And he wants to put Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block. He's in it for his wealthy donors,
not
working people.
Your time is up, but just to be specific, let me exercise the moderator's option. Should it be renewed, reviewed each year?
It should not be discretionary spending.
Okay.
It should not be discretionary spending.
Senator?
So let me make myself very clear. I want to save Social Security. I want to save Medicare. The greatest threat to Social Security and Medicare is the completely out of control deficit spending and our growing debt. We've added $7.5 trillion of new deficits over just the last 3 years. That is the greatest threat. That is what has also sparked inflation, 40-year high inflation. Do you realize that a dollar you held at the start of the Biden administration is only worth 88.3 cents? If you are a senior, fortunate enough to have a little nest egg, let's say $100,000 for ease of calculation, that $100,000 that you had at the start of the Biden administration is only worth $88,300 because of the out-of-control deficit spending. What I've been saying is we should be looking at all spending so we can prioritize, and Social Security, Medicare would be at the top of the priority list. I've never, ever said I would cut it or put it in the chopping block. That is a false attack.
Called it a Ponzi scheme,
sir,
called it candy.
Never called it candy.
Lieutenant Governor, this is his time, and I'm going to add a little time to that, to once again, you have proposed reviewing Social Security rather than having it be what's called an entitlement, which means it goes on.
You're putting words in my mouth.
All right, sir.
I was talking
your words.
About we have part of the reason we're $31 trillion in debt now is because we separate mandatory versus discretionary spending.
Right.
We don't even look at 70% of the budget, and so we spend like drunken sailors on the other 30%. We need to combine everything. Look at all of it, so we start prioritizing spending. We can't afford, for example, to spend $369 billion on the Green New Deal fantasy that, of course, the Lieutenant Governor
supports. But back to entitlement
supports.
Versus review, your position.
Pardon?
Back to whether
it's
or not
it's an entitlement.
It
we have to honor those promises, but the greatest threat to those promises is the out-of-control deficit spending.
All right, thank you, Senator. Let's go to the next question, Monsi Ricosa. Oh, I'm sorry. My mistake. Let's go to the next question with Brad Williams from WISM Radio in La Crosse.
And our question is about minimum wage. Many Americans continue to struggle to make a living wage. When it comes to the federal minimum wage, you both have said you support an increase in the minimum wage. Given the rise in inflation we've seen this past year, specifically, what dollar figure would you support setting the minimum wage at? And why? And Senator Johnson, you're first. You have 1 minute.
Well, I said I would consider possibly increasing it to a certain extent, then maybe indexing it toward inflation. I think you'd have to be very careful because when you increase the minimum wage, you can also eliminate jobs. So I think a strong economy is the best approach to this thing. I really don't like the federal government getting involved in doing price fixing and anything, and that includes wages. If you have a strong economy, which we had under the previous administration, you had plenty of jobs and you had rising wages. I think the something like $2,000 to $4,000 per year is what the average family increased their wage by. So that's the best thing, is have the marketplace take care of it rather than government set a minimum wage, which then starts eliminating jobs. And of course, it doesn't do you much good if you have a higher minimum wage and you don't have a job, then you have a zero wage.
Lieutenant Governor Barnes.
Thank you so much. Now, the senator threw out a figure with a nest egg and inflation. Let's just say it was right. Now, the reality is people have been making $7.25 since 2009. That's the last time the federal minimum wage went up. Wisconsin still has a $7.25 minimum wage. I've long been a proponent of a $15 minimum wage. Since 2014, when the advocates and hardworking people started calling for it, we should absolutely be at a $15 minimum wage. People are working harder than they've ever worked before, but they're not making the money they used to. Now, if Senator Johnson is serious about addressing inflation, we have to make sure that people can actually keep up with their bills. There's no reason that people who work full-time should struggle to pay the bills, but that is the reality right now. And it will continue to be the reality if we have people in office who are only going to prioritize the richest people in this country and leave hard-working people behind.
All right, let's go to the next question to Monsi Ricosa of Telemundo.
I'm going to ask a series of questions on abortion. Let's start with the most general one. Here in Wisconsin, since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we are governed by an 1849 law that bans all abortions except in the life of a mother. Polls say over 60% of Wisconsin residents oppose the overturning of Roe. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, you have said you disagree with overturning Roe v. Wade. Senator Johnson, one of your ideas is to allow citizens to vote at a state level, but just this week, the Wisconsin legislature gaveled in and gaveled out, rejecting the opportunity to allow such votes. So let's talk specifically about what you would do at the national level regarding abortion. Lieutenant Governor Barnes, you have 1 minute.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm an only child, but I'm not my mother's only pregnancy. Before I was born, my mother had a complicated pregnancy, and she had an abortion. She shared her story because she wanted others to know that they aren't alone and that it was her decision to make, not some politicians. And every woman should be able to make that decision. And doctors shouldn't have to live under the threat of being criminalized for helping women through their most difficult decisions. Now, the senator called the overturning of Roe versus Wade a victory. He celebrated the Dobbs decision. And he said that if women don't like the laws of their state, like the 1849 criminal abortion ban we have here, he said they can move. I can't think of a more callous, out of touch, or extreme position to take. If I were in the U.S. Senate, I would absolutely vote to codify Roe versus Wade to protect the right to an abortion and the right to choose into law once and for all to protect women's rights.
Thank you. Senator Johnson?
Well, as Justice Alito said, this is a profound moral issue. And it shouldn't be decided by 9 justices, not 535 members of Congress, and quite honestly, not even 132 members of the Wisconsin State Legislature. What we should do, and by the way, the most extreme position here would be no limits on abortion whatsoever, allowing an abortion right up to the moment of birth, which is what the lieutenant governor supports. So what I've recommended is let we the people decide with a one-time, single-issue referendum that asks the decision that we need to come to a decision on, which is at what point does society have the responsibility to protect life in the womb? We all agree that society has responsibility to protect life, but at what point does society have the responsibility to protect life in the womb? I want we the people to decide that. I would have one vote like every other Wisconsin citizen.
Your follow-up?
Let's get into some specifics regarding how the overturning of Roe impacts other areas of reproductive health. Some women have concerns with a Senate composed of 3/4 men making these decisions for them. What are your thoughts on When Life Begins, specifically as it relates to birth control, the morning after pill, and additional embryos created through IVF or in vitro fertilization? Senator Johnson, you have 1 minute.
Well, I've laid out all these answers to these questions on wisfacts.com, so you can refer to that. But I obviously support birth control. I support in vitro fertilization. My daughter had 2 children through gestational surrogacy. So I support all those things. I would never, ever consider charging a woman who had an unplanned pregnancy. But I lay it all out there on wisfacts.com. I've been very transparent about this. This has been a divisive issue for 50 years. Because 9 justices made a decision for all of us and it didn't solve the problem. So the best thing, and that's why I support overturning Roe v. Wade, is to turn it back to the states where we the people can make that decision. And again, the question that has to be answered is at what point does society have the responsibility to protect life? It's just that simple. And I've actually laid out a sample referendum ballot, and you can also find that at wisfacts.com.
Okay, Lieutenant Governor Barnes.
Well, the senator knows very well that the referendum won't happen with the legislature we have now. This is him trying to run away from his dangerous, out of touch, and extreme position. And when you take a position like that, there's so much that you don't always see. Let's talk about Texas as an example. There's a woman who had to be hooked up to a breathing machine because she had complications with her pregnancy and could not get an abortion. A 10-year-old girl in Ohio was raped and had to cross state lines to get an abortion. That's Ron Johnson's America. And 70% of the people think Roe versus Wade should be the law of the land here. Now, when we talk about children and unplanned pregnancies, Senator Johnson once went so far as to say it's not his responsibility to take care of our children in this country. Won't even support the child tax credit. Now, people are dealing with some very tough circumstances, but the senator would rather make a political point than to do the right thing to protect families and to protect the health of women.
Thank you. Let's now move on to A.J. Byatpour.
We are here, of course, in the city of Milwaukee, which is on pace for a 3rd consecutive year to set a record number of homicides in a single year. Now, the city of Milwaukee currently gives more money to its police department than any other city agency. What is the role of Congress in addressing such violent surges in American cities, if such a role should exist? For each of you, what are 3 specific actions Congress should take, if any, to address violence? Lieutenant Governor Barnes, you go first. You'll each have 1 minute.
Thank you so much. I can't speak for anybody else, but I know the pain of losing a loved one to gun violence. Have experienced that actually more times than I care to count. Lost my first friend in high school and several others after. Now, I know it doesn't have to be this way because it wasn't always this way. When my granddad moved to Milwaukee after World War II, he got a job as a union steel worker in a safe city. But when factories started to close their doors, we saw a decline in opportunity, but unfortunately, we also saw a rise in crime and in violence. Now, what we need to do is make sure that communities have the resources they need to prevent crime from happening in the first place. That means fully funding our schools. It also means making sure that there are good paying jobs in communities. And we also invested $100 million in the law enforcement, public safety, and crime prevention initiatives through the American Rescue Plan, which Senator Johnson voted against because another instance where he decided to play politics instead of putting the safety of the people of Wisconsin first.
Senator Johnson.
The first thing you do is you support law enforcement. And unfortunately, the lieutenant governor has not done that. He has a record of wanting to defund the police. Now, I know he doesn't necessarily say that word, but he has a long history of being supported by people that are leading the effort to defund. He uses the code words like Cori Bush said, talk about reallocate, overbloated police budgets. It says that, he says it pains him to see fully funded police budgets. So that's his views. Whenever I see a police officer, I go up to him and I say, thank you for your service. And if I have time, I say, please don't be dispirited by the loud few who are trying to defund you. By the way, they are being dispirited. Because of that defund the police effort, it is very difficult to recruit. We are 1,000 officers below where we were in Wisconsin just from 2008. And people are having a very difficult time. Sheriffs are having a very difficult time recruiting new officers, where they may have had 100 recruits, they might have a dozen. So again, all this defund the police effort is having
We're
a very harmful impact
Thank you. You've gone on over your time, Senator.
Law enforcement.
Thank you. We'll now go on to Mark Leland.
Thank you. We're going to talk more on gun legislation. Following the mass shootings this year and with assault-style weapons in both Uvalde and Buffalo, the bipartisan gun safety law was passed this summer. But polls show Americans want Congress to do more. To that end, what restrictions, if any, would you put on the sale of military-style assault weapons? And when it comes to mandatory background checks to buy a firearm, do you agree with overwhelming bipartisan public support of that plan? We'll start with Senator Johnson. You have 1 minute.
Well, first of all, you have to understand we have something like 10,000 gun control laws on the books throughout America. If gun control were the solution, it would have already been solved. It's not the solution. If we want to cut down on crime, the overall macro issue is we need to renew faith, strengthen families, have more supportive communities. Another gun control law just isn't going to work. But as long as we have them, I would suggest maybe enforcing them. There was something like 112,000 failed background checks in the year 2017. There were 12 prosecutions. So before you pass any new gun control laws, why don't you try enforcing the ones on the books? And then why don't we take a look at what's happening within our society that is causing all of this violence?
Lieutenant Governor?
Thank you so much. And as I mentioned before, I have dealt with this too much. And that's why I spent my entire career working to make communities safer. Now, an overwhelming majority of people in the state, as you mentioned, support background checks. People don't think that domestic abusers should be able to get a handgun. And neither do I. And unfortunately, Senator Johnson doesn't agree. The ATF doesn't even have searchable databases right now because of the laws on the books. And the senator on the last question did mention, you know, police officers. Now, with that being said, I'm sure he didn't have the same interaction with 140 officers that were injured during the January 6th insurrection. One officer was stabbed with a metal stake, another crushed between a revolving door, another hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. So when we talk about respect for law enforcement, let's talk about the 140 officers that he left behind because of an insurrection that he supported. Now, with that being said, there is so much more we need to do to keep guns out of the hand of violent criminals.
Lieutenant Governor, just once again, for specifics, the questions were about background checks.
Oh, I absolutely support background checks. I support it as legislator, support it now as lieutenant governor. And we need senators who support background checks. We need senators who aren't bought and paid for by the gun lobby. Senator Johnson received $1.2 million from the gun lobby. That's why he can't be trusted. That's why he's going to make up every excuse about why we can't do anything. He was elected to do a job. This is what he's supposed to do, help keep us safe. But he refuses to because the gun lobby is propping
him up. We're at time. Thank you. All right, let's move on now. We're going to take another question. This one is from Kim Murphy, who can't be with us tonight because of COVID protocols, but it's going to be asked on her behalf by Dale Ryman.
Thank you, Joe. I want to talk about the Electoral College reform. After the January 6th assault on the Capitol, the effort to present a false slate of electors from 7 states, including Wisconsin, a bipartisan group of 32 senators has proposed the Electoral Count Reform Act. The key provisions include identifying a single conclusive slate of electors, affirming the role of the vice president, raising the objection threshold, and protecting each state's popular vote. Lieutenant Governor, we will go to you first for 1 minute. Do you support this bill?
Well, we all saw what happened on January 6th. We also saw every conspiracy theory peddled. We saw the senator attempt to send fake electors to the vice president, saying that his involvement lasted a matter of seconds. That matter of seconds ended up with a whole day assault on the Capitol. They threatened to hang the vice president. Now, we have to do as much as we can to protect our democracy. The very first plan my campaign put out was a democracy and accountability agenda. Now, the senator doesn't seem to like a democracy because it has not been working out for him. But the reality is, if we modernize our electoral count system, we can prevent something like this from happening again, and we can restore trust into our electoral process. People don't trust the process because we have folks elected to high office who will spend their time trying to overturn an election, trying to cast doubt into a free and fair election, which election observers said was the most secure in our lifetime.
Senator Johnson?
I would support that piece of legislation. I do want to remind everybody that when I got back to my office on January 6th, because I was not impacted by what was happening at the Capitol, I didn't know what was happening until I turned on the TV, I immediately and forcefully and have repeatedly condemned it and condemned it strongly. But I've also condemned the 570 riots that occurred during the summer. So many people ignore those. The Lieutenant Governor has made excuses for those rioters, say, well, what do you expect? They're frustrated. If you want to talk about rioting, we should take a look at what happened in Kenosha. The day after the first night of rioting, when the used car lot was set on fire, instead of trying to calm things down, the Lieutenant Governor gave a press conference and he said it felt like a vendetta was carried out against one of our community members. He incited the riot. He and the governor didn't provide the manpower to stop the riots. So if you're going to focus on a riot, why don't we focus on 570 riots, 2,000
police
Senator. Officers
Your
injured.
Your time is up. Dale, you have a follow-up.
Yes. Last month, I had a chance to interview former Vice President Mike Pence when he was visiting Wausau. When referring to his actions on January 6th, when he resisted pressure from former President Trump to overturn the election, and refused to accept the slates of fake state electors, including some that were offered to him by Senator Johnson's office. He said he acted out of respect for the U.S. Constitution. We'd like for you both to go on the record. Did the former vice president do the right thing? Senator Johnson, you can go first. You have 1 minute.
Well, first of all, let me clear things up here. I had no idea when I got a call from the lawyer from the President of the United States to deliver something to the vice president, did I have a staff member that could help out with that? I had no idea what it was. The fact of the matter was, nothing was delivered. The whole episode took less than an hour, but I wasn't even involved. So again, I had no knowledge of an alternate slate of electors. I voted to confirm, you know, not to disallow any of President Biden's electors. So from my standpoint, this is a non-issue. But I know it's being blown out because everyone wants to focus on January 6th when we also ought to be looking at the violence that occurred in 570 riots. Again, 2,000 law enforcement officers injured in those riots. A couple dozen people lost their lives, including two in Kenosha, because the Lieutenant Governor and the Governor Evers didn't provide the type of manpower to quell those riots. About $1 to $2 billion worth of property damage. Why don't we focus a little bit on 570 riots as well?
Senator Johnson, your time is up. But again, the question was, did Mike Pence do the right thing on January 6th?
Yes. You know, President Biden is now President of the United States.
Well, I will say that to push back, the Republican sheriff of Kenosha said that the governor answered every call and gave all the resources that they requested. So let's clear that up. And he may not have noticed that an insurrection was happening because he called those people patriots. He called them tourists. These are the folks that he supported. This is an act that he supported. And he can make whatever comparisons he wants to, but the reality is this was an attempted overthrow of the government by trying to overturn a free and fair election. So the answer is yes. The vice president did do the right thing.
All right, let's go to the next question, and that goes to Brad Williams.
We'll turn to the issue of safe water. From Racine to Wausau to Rhinelander, people are concerned about the safety of their drinking water because the water contains excessive levels of man-made and industrial chemicals called PFAS, which have been linked to illnesses and conditions including cancer and infertility. For example, hundreds of families on French Island in the La Crosse area have been supplied with bottled water for the past year because of high levels of PFAS in their well water. The cost of supplying clean water has been shifted to families and local governments. What should Congress do to provide financial relief to towns and families affected by this pollution? This question first goes to Lieutenant Governor Barnes. You have 1 minute.
Well, thank you so much. Clean water, safe drinking water, it's an issue in so many parts of the state, and it's one of the unfortunate realities that actually brings people together. This is something we should all come to expect in the most civilized, the most wealthy nation on the entire planet, but it's not the reality. And this is a freshwater state. We got Lake Michigan to the east, Superior to the north, and the Mississippi River to the west. And I have spent my time in the office of Lieutenant Governor working on clean water issues. In fact, 2019, the governor declared it the year of clean drinking water. Now, we've issued a number of grants, but we need help and support from the federal government. We should also talk about lead lateral lines in cities across Wisconsin as well, which the bipartisan infrastructure law went to go fund. Now, this is another instance that the senator voted against the interests of people. He voted against our health and safety, whether it's PFAS contamination or lead contamination.
Lieutenant Governor, once again, more specifically, what, if anything, do you think needs to be done at the federal level?
My apologies. We do have a responsibility. The federal government absolutely has a responsibility to fund the initiatives that would make sure that every community has access to clean and safe drinking water. And also, we have a responsibility to make sure that polluters are held accountable.
Senator Johnson.
Well, I suggest that the EPA, rather than focus on CO2, focus on these pollutants that really are harmful. And for example, rather than spend $369 billion, which is what is going to be spent or allocated based on the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a very Orwellian name bill because it won't reduce inflation, it'll probably further enhance it. We ought to take that $369 billion, a portion of that, and we can allocate that toward addressing real pollution, which is what PFAS is.
All right, let's go to the next question, and that will go to Monse Ricosa.
I'd like to talk about the Respect for Marriage Act. When Roe versus Wade was overturned, Justice Clarence Thomas referred to other decisions, which would include gay marriage and interracial marriage, as potentially overturned, or had the potential to be overturned. In response to that, Senator Baldwin and Collins have proposed bipartisan legislation called the Respect for Marriage Act, which makes it the law of the land and protects it from being overturned. How would you vote, Senator Johnson?
So first of all, I've always supported civil unions. When the Supreme Court ruled a different way and ruled for gay marriage, I thought, okay, there's an issue, it's been settled, let's move on. We have a lot of other problems we have to deal with. That Supreme Court decision will never be overturned. This is another scare tactic by the left. I know Justice Thomas kind of opened up the door, but this is where stare decisis is very powerful, where you're not going to disrupt millions of lives. I don't want millions of lives disrupted. But there's another element to this thing. If you, certainly the way the law is written right now, it threatens religious liberty. So before I would ever consider voting for that bill, I would want to see very strong protections for religious liberty. We've seen what happened after the Obergefell decision. You had people starting to sue, for example, bakers. One in the Supreme Court, but they're right back after harassing that guy again. So I would need very strong religious liberty protections.
Thank you, Senator. Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Governor Barnes.
Thank you so much. We're talking about a civil right. We're talking about the right for a person to marry who they love. Normally, this would be a no-brainer. This is something I've supported as a member of the legislature, and it's something I would be proud to support as a member of the United States Senate. Now, he said that the Supreme Court decision won't be overturned. A lot of people thought that Roe wouldn't be overturned. But look at us now. We're in a position where we are losing rights. People are having fewer rights than they had 50 years ago. That's exactly what's on the line with this election. We need people who are going to fight for our fundamental freedoms. To be able to marry who you love, again, that should be a no-brainer. It's a shame that we're in this place right now having this same old tired argument. But here we are. We need people who are going to fight to make sure you can love who you love and also make your own health care decisions without interference from politicians.
Okay, our next question once again is coming from Kim Murphy, but it's going to be addressed by Mark Leland.
Thank you. Kim's question is on climate change. The death toll from Hurricane Ian is at least 120 people now. The storm made landfall as a devastating Category 4. Scientists say the historic storm was fueled by warm waters, and those warmer waters are a direct effect on climate change. What would be three specific solutions you believe in for addressing climate change? Lieutenant Governor Barnes, we'll begin with you. You have 1 minute.
Well, the climate crisis is already here. It's impacting places all over the country, all over the globe, Wisconsin specifically. I've had a chance to visit our family farmers who have had to deal with the impacts of devastation from these 100, 500 year storms that are happening more regularly. Flooding events, historic flooding events that are wiping out rural infrastructure, and also impact on cities with urban heat islands. Now, the senator just a couple questions ago, said that CO2 is not harmful. He's gone so far as to call climate change BS. These are people's lives we're talking about. This is our future that we're talking about. What we need to do is reduce carbon emissions. What we also need to do is move towards a clean energy economy and make sure Wisconsin is in the driver's seat. 80% of the world's solar panels built in China. We could be building those right here in Wisconsin, charting the path to a clean energy future. And we also can make sure that our family farmers have the support that they need with regenerative agriculture so that the industry can continue
to
thrive.
Thank you. It's the senator's turn.
So the climate has always changed, always will change, so I don't deny climate change. The question is, can you really do anything about it? When China, when India, they're going to be burning fossil fuels, America's going to have to burn fossil fuels. 80% of our energy comes from fossil fuels right now, and that's not going to change anytime soon because wind and solar are not reliable. They make our grid very unreliable. The reason you're paying now more than $4 a gallon at the pump is because of the Democrats' war on fossil fuels. Again, it's this green energy in terms of converting over to electric vehicles. We don't have the rare earth minerals. We can't build the batteries. One of the things we're seeing down in Florida is those electric vehicles are starting on fire. They're exploding. So there are a lot of problems here. So we have to focus on how we use fossil fuels responsibly. We simply can't be afford spending hundreds of billions of dollars trying to solve a problem that's not solvable.
Thank you. You have both been so efficient in your responses that we've been able to continue with 1-minute answers for you. So we'll continue on that path for a while without cutting you to 30. So with that, let us go to A.J. Bhayadpour.
The White House's student loan debt forgiveness plan is widely supported by young Americans. However, many other voters believe it is unfair. Do you think it is fair or not to forgive up to $20,000 in student loan debt? You each have 1 minute. Senator Johnson, you'll go first.
I think it's grossly unfair. And I think people who never went to college or people that scrimped and saved and sacrificed and paid off their student loan are not particularly happy that a group of people who voluntarily entered into a loan agreement now get that. It's really not forgiven, it's just transferred onto the back of other Americans. By the way, ever since the federal government took over the student loan program, those student loans have exploded, as has the cost of college. Since the 1960s, when we started keeping track of this, the cost of college has increased at 2.7 times the rate of inflation, largely because we're throwing so much money into it. I mean, what is so different about what colleges and universities spend their money on than the rest of society? What's different is the federal government has fueled that rise in college costs. So we ought to focus on that. But no, this is grotesquely unfair for people who never went to college or paid off their student loans.
Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you so much. I actually got a family member, Dennis. Hope he doesn't mind me using his name, but he didn't see college as four-year college as his path in life. He went to the trades. He became an electrician. He's making a great living right now. And it's important for us to think about the other paths people choose in life. Now, the deeper problem is that college is absolutely unaffordable. Costs continue to rise. We can go back to one of the older questions about the minimum wage. Costs continue to rise, especially with college. And we're talking about people who make minimum wage in many cases to support themselves during their time in college. So, of course, we should forgive some student loan debt, but we also need to make it easier for people in vocational education, also people in technical education, so that they can have the opportunity to get ahead and we can actually rebuild the middle class. Now, Senator Johnson has been against every form of government support for students in college. If you have a federal student loan debt right now, Senator Johnson did not want you to have it.
So just specifically, the question was about, was it fair?
People are being saddled with student loan debt, burdened with student loan debt, cannot fully participate in the economy. My generation is the first to be that's slated to be worse off than the generation before us. That is a travesty. It is a shame that many people in my generation have fewer opportunities than my granddad had after he came back from World War II. So absolutely it's fair that people get some student loan relief.
All right, we go to Mark Leland.
One of the White House's stated reasons for adopting student loan forgiveness is it would narrow the racial wealth gap. Just yesterday, a federal judge in Green Bay dismissed a lawsuit brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The lawsuit argued the White House plan had an improper racial motive. The group plans to appeal. At the federal level, whether it's with student loans or anything else, what, if anything, should Congress do to address the racial wealth gap? Lieutenant Governor Barnes, we'll begin with you. You have 1 minute.
Well, absolutely. And as I mentioned earlier, my granddad moved here after World War II. He got a job as a union steel worker. And that's the story of a whole lot of black men in the city of Milwaukee. And again, when those opportunities dried up, there was nothing really that came in to fill the void. And we saw, again, those rises in crime, which also led to rises in incarceration, so many other devastating results because of deindustrialization, because offshoring, a practice that has been supported and championed by Senator Johnson. He says offshoring makes sense, ignoring the toll that it has taken on communities like right here in the city of Milwaukee. We need to do more to make sure that there are good paying jobs in communities. We need to do more to make sure that our low income schools are fully funded. We need to do more to make sure that every single person in this country has health care. That's what helps us close these gaps we've been experiencing along racial lines.
All right, I am told by the official timekeepers that we can now move to 30-second questions.
Senator Johnson has a minute. Senator
Johnson, my apologies.
I think you're aware of my JILSA project. That is where I've teamed up with a church in the inner city of Milwaukee, and in 4 days of training, we instill the requirement, the need for a good attitude and committing to success. And this is with formerly incarcerated drug and alcohol abusers, and we get them real career type of jobs. We transformed their lives. Hundreds, thousands of people have been positively impacted by that. That's how you do it. You don't do it by spending trillions of dollars of money that we don't have, sparking 40-year high inflation, again, that has taken a dollar that you had at the start of the Biden administration, turned that into 88.3 cents. That helps no one. It certainly doesn't help the black community.
Thank you.
You have more time on your minute if you would like to
go on. The other thing we shouldn't be doing is letting loose 87,000 IRS agents on middle-class families, because that's what's going to happen. Lieutenant Governor Barnes supports that.
Right. We will now move to our 30-second questions, and my apologies for stepping on your response there. All right. We now go to, Mark Leland. No, I'm sorry. It's Brad Williams.
Turning to the Supreme Court, following recent rulings, surveys have shown public confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court is at its lowest level in years. Critics of the court have suggested changes, such as replacing lifetime appointments with term limits or expanding the court beyond 9 justices. They have also proposed more strict ethical oversight of the High Court because of conflicts of interest. Would you support any or all of these ideas for court reform, and why? We start with Senator Johnson. You have 30 seconds.
Well, the reason people are complaining is because they're leftists themselves. They're biased media. They don't like it when you have a Supreme Court that has conservative justices that actually just apply the law rather than try and alter it. So I'm utterly opposed to judicial activists, and that's, of course, what the liberal press likes, is an activist court. And so when you finally have gotten conservative justices, and by the way, I vote for conservative justices knowing full well that I'm not going to like some of their decisions because they're going to apply the law, alter it.
Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Governor?
I mentioned the first plan from this campaign was a democracy and accountability agenda. One of the most important provisions in that plan was to impose ethics standards on the Supreme Court. Our justices should abide by the same exact sets of standards that every other court in the country has to abide by. And I also support term limits for U.S. Supreme Court justices. These shouldn't be lifetime appointments.
All right. Let's now go to A.J. Byatt-Port.
There was a new development this week potentially involving gas prices. Despite President Biden's attempt to persuade OPEC to do otherwise, the group of oil exporting countries decided this week it will cut oil production, a move that will most likely cause gas prices to rise. How should Congress respond? Again, you each have 30 seconds for this. Lieutenant Governor, you'll go first.
Well, the problem is our reliance on fossil fuels in the first place. We need to be more energy independent. We need to do more to generate renewable energy in this country, specifically right here in Wisconsin. Now, the senator's going to say that the path forward is fossil fuels. He's going to make up every excuse for the fossil fuel industry. We need to hold them accountable for using inflation as a smokescreen to jack up prices on the American people. And look, the senator's received hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign support from the fossil fuel industry, and that's why he's going to put their interests before your pocketbook.
Senator.
If you want to have lower gas prices, you need to be energy independent. We were energy independent under the last administration. If you're concerned about climate change, you should be supporting nuclear power. But most environmentalists oppose nuclear power. So there's a solution here. It's just environmentalists like Lieutenant Governor Barnes won't embrace the real solution.
All right, we have one more question. Let's go to Dale Ryman.
It's being said broadband is not a luxury. It's a necessity for everyday living. The pandemic really showed us how important broadband is, in particular with online learning and telehealth. Wisconsin ranks 33rd in the country in Broadband Now's annual rankings of internet coverage, speed, and availability. How will you advocate for Wisconsinites on Capitol Hill to continue to close that digital divide? Senator Johnson, we'll start with you first, and you have 30 seconds.
So I have a pretty strong record here. I've supported the Connect America Fund, and that allocated hundreds of millions of dollars here. Also, to get proper mapping of broadband, and that resulted in about $10 billion over 10 years of federal funding to expand broadband here in Wisconsin. So I'm completely aware of the crucial need for broadband, and I've supported it, and I've gotten federal funding for Wisconsin as a result.
And specifically toward the future? We'll continue to do
so? Precisely.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
Well, I'm proud to say that our administration has invested historic sums of money into broadband expansion. I've held a number of broadband roundtables across the state, and we all hear the heartbreaking stories of students having to go to a fast food restaurant parking lot just to get connected during the pandemic. I've heard stories of people outside of Wausau who had to actually go to a funeral home because that's who had the best Wi-Fi. Now, one of the best opportunities to expand broadband in this state has been the bipartisan infrastructure bill, another bipartisan piece of legislation that Senator Johnson voted
against because he wanted to put politics first. And we are at our last question, which we promised you would give you a chance to perhaps clear up some misconceptions. Dale?
Gentlemen, so during this debate or in campaign ads, you have heard things said about you that you believe are just plain wrong. In this last question, we want to give you the floor to set things straight. What's been said about you that you really want to knock down? Senator Johnson, you can go first, and you have 1 minute.
Well, I'm very proud of my record as your U.S. Senator. One of the more grotesque distortions, in addition to the fact that I actually want to save Social Security, is the fact that I got a tax cut only for myself and a couple supporters. No. It's because of me, 95% of American businesses got a tax cut so they can compete with the big guys and survive the pandemic. That was 20 million tax filers. So I'm proud of my record in terms of tax reform. Again, allowing people to compete with the big C corps as well as survive the pandemic. But my right to try legislation, that is saving people's lives. My JOSER project is transforming lives. And my background, my experience, 40 years of working in the private sector, I'm not sure what the Lieutenant Governor has ever done in terms of a job in the private sector. I know his mom's a teacher, his dad worked third shift. I also work third shift. So I know exactly what it's like to work in a factory. I know what it's like to work shift work. I know what it's like to create jobs because I've created them. I don't believe he has.
Thank you, Senator.
Lieutenant Governor?
Well, actually, embrace one of the characterizations in one of the ads that they put out, either Senator Johnson or one of his allies. It ends by saying, Mandela Barnes, different. I embrace that because we don't have enough working class people in the United States Senate. The Senate is broken. Senator Johnson is one of the worst parts of a broken system, a person who has been in it for himself and his wealthy donors. Sure, if you're a multimillionaire, he'll look out for you. But if you're a working class person, it might not be so easy. That's the unfortunate reality. People are continuing to be left behind, and that's exactly why I'm running right now. Our lives and our livelihoods are on the line at this very moment. Our seniors have to live with the threat of Social Security and Medicare being cut. Working people have to live under the threat of their jobs being shipped overseas. Women have to live with the threat of their most personal decisions being interrupted by politicians. That's what's on the line right now. But I believe better is possible. I believe hard work can pay off, and we can give everyone a fair shot at the American dream.
We'd like to thank both of you, and we'd also like to thank the teams that have helped us tonight. So we're going to thank A.J. Bhaiyadpour, Mark Leland, Kim Murphy, who we wish could have been with us, Monse Ricosa, Dale Ryman, Brad Williams, and our data team, who's been working behind the scenes to give you information so you can read more about it on the WBA's debate website and our social media accounts. And to find those, obviously, you can look them up, use the hashtag WBADebate. And that data team, by the way, is Emily Davies, Scotty Lee Myers, and Michelle Bike, and all of their stations that have contributed their time to this effort. We'd also like to thank Wisconsin Public Broadcasting here in Milwaukee for hosting us. And now, let us go to WBA President and CEO, Michelle Vetterkind.
Thank you for joining us for tonight's debate, an opportunity for Wisconsin citizens to hear from the leading U.S. Senate candidates. This debate has been sponsored by our WBA Foundation through a grant from the Wisconsin Association of Independent Colleges and Universities and the Wisconsin Counties Association. Our sincere thanks to the Wisconsin radio and TV stations who work together to produce and air this broadcast, to the candidates, our moderator, our panelists, and our data team. As always, WBA member stations will be on duty to bring you election results. Election Day is Tuesday, November 8th. Exercise your right as an American and vote.